I'm John Alsever. I guess that's the best way to start. And I'm a medical doctor, and I've practiced medicine now for 13 years, if I exclude the length of time I went to school. My specialty is obstetrics and gynecology, which is childbirth and diseases or illnesses of women, specifically the reproductive system. A lot of doctors say that 80% of what we see in our office is psychosomatic medicine, psychologically induced illnesses. And I'm sure that if we had people in internal medicine or family practice that were here, that they would also tell you that. And that means that we're spending an awful lot of money, if we don't count the amount of stress on our nerves, on illnesses that, by examining the way we live our life and the way we think inside of ourselves, feel about ourselves, we might be able to cut down on our health expenditures, which is one of the things that's a national priority. I don't like to think about it from the dollar standpoint, although I get trapped into doing that occasionally. I like to think more about it in the sense of freedom and how free I am to be happy in my life and to feel good in my life and to live my life as long as I'd like to live it, which is a good long while that I would choose. And so I begin to look at what I'm doing now, because that's going to have some effects on how I live my life 20 years from now. I'd like to kind of look at what is stress. We talk about it, and people talk about stress reduction or stress provoking incidents, and so I kind of thought about that a little in preparation for this. Basically, what I came up with is that stress can be either a physical situation, a bear in camp, or it can be an emotional situation, like getting ready to present this talk, which leads to some feelings that, kind of going back a little bit, that situation, especially if I think about an emotional situation, can be either a real situation, a death in the family, or it can be imagined situation. In other words, I can have a dream about a death in the family, which may be, although it's not a reality event at that particular time, it may have just as much impact on my level of stress for that morning or so as the real event. That leads to feelings. The feelings there, it's hard for me to divorce feelings from what happens in my body. We talk about the knot in my stomach or the neck that I get that's a little stiff. And so feelings are actually body perceptions that we have, that we've learned to call certain names. Well, that means that something's going on in our body, and I can't divorce the feeling from the body reaction. And if we look at the most basic form of stress in terms of a physical event which is threatening, you begin to get what researchers found years ago was a flight or fight reaction. And this was very basic. It's most easily and most fun to think about in the form of cavemen and saber-toothed tigers. And the caveman meeting a saber-toothed tiger knew that he needed to do something pretty quickly, or something would be done to him. And he mobilized his body defenses and ran like heck. And the mobilization of his body reaction is the same reaction that we still have when if we were to face a saber-toothed tiger, for instance, that there are a number of things that go on at that point for us. Our adrenal gland, which is somewhere in this part of our body back inside a ways, goes squeeze, and that pushes a lot of adrenaline into our system. And what happens with that is that it speeds up our heart rate, it speeds up our breathing, we breathe faster, but not quite as deep. All of the blood vessels in our intestinal area constrict down, and the blood vessels in our muscles open up, the blood vessels in our skin constrict down, which is why when you're nervous you get cold, sweaty hands. And those prepare you to either fight, because you'll need muscular activity for that, or flight, run. And that reaction is, and what we're talking about here in terms of a very confrontive kind of situation, basic. Now, during the day, we face different kinds of tigers. They're not on 4 feet with fur and long teeth. There are different kinds of tigers that we all face. Some of them we create in our own minds, and some of them are actual in our day-to-day living. To try and summarize a little bit, the stress reaction or stress response that we have in our body basically is a life-saving response. In other words, it works to our advantage. And yet, now in this day and age, we're finding it beginning to work a little bit to our disadvantage. And so that's the aspect of it that I'm interested in exploring just a little bit and talking to you more about. Let's see, there's stages of stress, if you want to put down stages. There's the immediate, which is the flight or fright. There's the response to that, which is either to run away or to stay and fight. And then sets in a set of exhaustion. And I think trying to pick a fairly common incident that may have happened to almost everyone in the room, and that is, as you're driving your car, there are undoubtedly a few episodes of getting in a close call. You know, whew, gee, if I hadn't reacted so fast or something hadn't happened, would have gotten smashed up. And then you pull off to the side of the road because you find that you begin shaking or your knees turn to water. Whatever it is, you just cannot continue to go on. And that's kind of a general body reaction, and that's the exhaustion reaction that happens after you've dealt with whatever it is that's gone on. Exhaustion happens in another way, and that is when your alarm reaction is there, you respond, not fully, but partially respond, and you continue to have stressors ongoing so that you're at that chronic response level. After a while, exhaustion sets in. And there are a lot of people in our society, people that I see in my office, that are in the exhaustion stage of the stress response, and at that point they can't respond effectively to continued stress, which is often why they've gotten sick, or often why they're in my office, is that is they just can't cope anymore. They cannot respond. Their poor adrenal is squeezed and stayed squeezed so long that it just isn't making enough to go now. And so that happens both on a short-term and a long-term basis. Short-term, we understand, all of us accept that as normal. We've all experienced that. What is difficult for us to understand, accept, and then begin to do something about is what happens in the chronic long-term stress. Well, I talked about repeated stresses that you go ahead and you just solve one after another, but you're presented with them all the time. The other one is that many of us pick out and choose unresolvable stress. And I'll pick a nice typical one for doctors, and I'm sure many of you may have it also, and that is that we're supposed to be perfect. We are supposed to do everything right. We're supposed to, if it's not right the first time, we're supposed to go back and correct it, and we're supposed to have it all together. be able to manage at all times. And that kind of a stress set up by myself with expectations for myself to meet leads to unresolvable stress for me. It's obvious I can't be perfect and I come down on myself when I'm not, and that produces the ongoing stress. Okay. The other kinds of things that you may get into are that are unresolvable are trying to control time. You set out to do more in a certain period of time than you can possibly get done in that period of time. And when you don't get it done, you know you're not getting it done, and you begin to set up the stress pattern, and that keeps going on. Other is trying to control other people's behavior. Those of us with teenage children may get into that fairly easily, because sometimes their behavior is not what we would like to have. And trying to control that ourselves obviously doesn't work very well. Well, what happens now long term when you take your blood vessels and you put them in a state of not fully constricted down as hard as they can get, but halfway constricted down as hard as they can get, and you maintain that for 10 years, 15 years? Well, number one, you've taken any muscle that you put under that kind of tension for 20 years is going to do something. It's going to kind of begin to freeze in that position. The way our blood vessels do that is by developing some injury to them, so they now collect a little cholesterol and fats in the wall, and they stay then at a partly constricted size. And well, what happens then? Well, then the doctor measures your blood pressure and he says, gee, your blood pressure's high. And a little later on, you begin to get the pain of what we call angina, which is that the blood vessels in the heart have constricted down a little bit, and now you can't get enough blood through there to get enough blood to the oxygen to the heart, and the heart's beginning to complain. And when the heart doesn't get enough oxygen, it says ouch, and people get what we call angina, and that ultimately may be a heart attack. Or the blood vessels in the brain are doing the same thing, and they're narrowed down. And so what happens then is that you don't get enough blood to the brain, and when that happens relatively suddenly, then you get a stroke. So that you can see that the ongoing stress over a long period of time with an appropriate stress response on the part of the body leads to disease in the body. Well, it happens in the same way. If my guts are all shut down in terms of their blood flow, what happens to them? Well, they don't move like they used to. They do some funny things in terms of what they absorb and what they don't absorb, and food stays there longer. They're shut down, they're not working because I'm under stress, and that makes me chronically constipated. Okay? And chronic constipation leads to an attempt on the part of the bowel to move things through. And that leads to cramping in the gut, and that leads to abdominal pain. And the number of people I see in my office on a daily basis with abdominal pain that's simply on the basis of bowel cramping because they're chronically constipated is two or three a day, different people. That's a little, if we look at three, that's about 10% of the people that I see in my office in a day. Well, what happens when you're chronically constipated? Well, you get hemorrhoids. How many people in the room know somebody who's had an operation for hemorrhoids? Probably quite a few of you. So hemorrhoids, and look at the drugstore the next time you go. They usually have their medicines are divided into different sections. And you go in, and that book rack in the back of the thing would be full of various different medications that you can spend your money on to help you with your hemorrhoids. Okay? And then the surgeon's making a fair amount of income from our tightened bowel. Well, what else does that have? Well, that leads to diverticulosis sometimes. Those are little pockets in the side of the bowel, and they occur because the bowel exerts an undue amount of pressure, and what happens is the weakest part goes, so in between the bundles of muscles, boom, out comes the little pocket. And what happens then is sometimes that gets full of stool material and stays full of stool material. Well, bacteria are part of stool. And so bacteria get in there and they set up an infection, and that causes diverticulosis, which again is fever and chills. and basically an abscess in your abdominal cavity. Not a very neat thing. So colitis is another thing. You may have heard of colitis. That's an inflammation in the bowel. And ultimately cancer. Why cancer? Well, a lot of research has been done on people with high-fiber diets versus low-fiber diets, the United States being low-fiber and some of the third world nations being high-fiber. And the thought is that the high-fiber keeps the stool soft, gives the bowel something to work on and push through, whereas if you have a low-fiber, there's just a little bit to push through, and the bowel has to, you know, get all spastic about it to get it on. And but it also moves more slowly with, and therefore things that we eat that may be cancer-producing agents stay in contact for a longer period of time with the inner wall of the gut and have more opportunity to influence us adversely. Well, now, what else? The muscles are ready or either holding back. If I'm primed to run and I'm sitting here talking to you, then I have to be doing something to counteract those muscles that want to run. So I'm either got tight muscles that want to run, or I have the opposite group of muscles that keep me from running tightened up, fighting with each other. Okay, well, what happens there? Well, I get tendonitis more often, and I probably get sore muscles more often. And over a period of time, I may very well develop arthritis processes, which are related to unusual stress on my joints for a prolonged period of time. You know, you'll meet hikers that go up and they carry a heavy pack up to a hole in lake, and they come back down limping, and they've got arthritis in their knee. It's a traumatic arthritis from overuse or unusual stress. And when you keep that going all the time in your own life, day to day, you don't notice it, because it doesn't hurt you until you've been tightened up on those muscles for the last 15 years. But that's how it begins to happen, and that's some of the reason why we're beginning to talk about stress and how you can react to stress. Well, who's to say now in your life you're not having any problems, maybe? Who's to say why you should look at stress? You're to say, you know, and you may sit here and you may take my little test here in a few minutes and you may say, hey, I scored one on that. That means I'm just really cool and I'm native. And that may be true. There may come a time in your life when you do feel under stress and you may want then to have some resources available to you. And I guess that's what I'm here to say, is there are a lot of resources now. A lot of them are fun, but they all take a little bit of time. The second person is to say how much stress is too much for you is the people that you live with. And sometimes I make my own stress and I live with it, and it's what I've grown up with. So to me, that seems like what's really life. And it's only as my wife says, gee, you seem pretty tense tonight, or my kids say, now, how come you're always so uptight, Dad, that I may then begin to get some feedback saying that maybe that level of tension that I'm living with is something that I can change. So that, and then the third one, which I think is the least valuable one, is the doctor. And if you go to your doctor and he says you've got high blood pressure, or you go to the doctor and he says, listen, Jim, you really better slow down because, you know, you're beginning to get some changes on your electrocardiogram and your blood pressure's not really high, but it's getting up there a little bit. And, you know, you made three appointments and we'd had to manipulate them because your schedule was so busy you couldn't keep your appointments. You need to look at changing your lifestyle a little bit, or you're going to be winding up another 5 years in my coronary intensive care unit. That's the last way that I would choose to learn more about stress. Well, I'd like to give you my little stress test, and you can either write down on the corner of your little piece of paper the numbers as I give you the questions, or you can add them up mentally. I had to use my fingers when I tried it mentally. And I want you to use this kind of grading system for yourself. If you rarely have this kind of thing, then you get a zero. If you do it a few times a week, then you get one. And if you find yourself doing it often, and you can define what often is for you, then give yourself a 2. I took the test, and I'm willing to tell you what I got on it, but I'll do that after we do it, okay? All righty. Feel tense, anxious, or have nervous indigestion. People at work or at home make me feel tense. I eat, drink, smoke in response to tension. I have tension or migraine headaches or pain in my neck or shoulders or trouble sleeping. Can't turn off my thoughts at night or on weekends long enough to feel relaxed and refreshed the next day. I find it difficult to concentrate on what I'm doing because of worrying about other things. I take tranquilizers or other drugs to relax. I have difficulty finding enough time to relax. Once I find the time, it's hard for me to relax. My workday is made up of many deadlines. Get yourself a total on those. If you score between 0 and 2, you're considerably below average in your tension level. If you score from 3 to 5, you're still below average. 6 to 9 is average. 10 to 13 is above average. 14 to 18 is considerably above average. I score 15. And I think that I feel an immediate need to defend it. I just reduced my stress level there. Okay. Well, it's kind of like my children. About 4 or 5 years ago, my wife and I we're going through what all parents go through, which is to say, gee, this is what they're doing. I wonder if that's normal for them. Because it always seemed as we lived in our own, what I feel is sheltered family, that nobody else's kids could be doing these kinds of things. And in our search for trying to find out that, we not only found some books that dealt with child behavior and what is normal, but we also found a book that says, now that you got them, what are you going to do with them? Which I love that kind of title. And I think at this point, as we look at stress, and now we've begun the first step, and that is beginning to build some awareness of our stress and what we encounter in our own life as stress. Now that we got it, what are we going to do with it? Is my next place. And I'm going to approach this in one way. There are many ways to approach it. The way that I'm going to approach it, I think, may seem a little hokey to you, or a little, oh gosh, that's like grade school again. But in following a fairly systematized approach, in writing things down, in measuring things, you will be required to become concrete in what you want to deal with. And one of the ways that I find that I sabotage myself is to remain general enough that I can't possibly either figure out what it is I'm going to do or measure it once I've done it. So writing it down helps me to be very concrete and specific about what it is I want to do. Measuring it before I've done my program to change and after I've done my program to change tells me whether I'm doing what I want to do. And you'll know that in a way in terms of you'll be more comfortable maybe, but it's nice to be able to say I've made a 50% reduction in that. And that's what I wanted to do. So those are two things that I think. The interesting thing, I think, about this kind of method that I'll share with you is that it's the same kind of method that we use in medical audit. And the steps are exactly the same. And we do the same things, but we're measuring something a little different. And it's probably things that other people are doing in other industries and other businesses in terms of measuring their performance. Just quality assurance is what we're doing. And so if you want to take quality assurance from any other field or medical field and put it into your own life, these are the steps. First, you identify the problem. Second, you decide whether you want to change it or not. Now that you know the problem, do you want to do anything about it or don't you? And so that's commitment. I hope there are no English teachers here. My mother tried for a whole summer in between junior high school and high school to get me to spell properly, and I still don't do that. It used to stress me a lot, and it doesn't stress me at all. Let's see. Identify the problem, commitment, or looking at whether you really want to change it. The third is what I would call tools for change right now. What did I write down? Further evaluation. That this third step, and I'll talk about it a little more, deals with... Now, how big a problem is it? Is it a problem that's solvable? Is there another problem that's bigger that you want to solve first? What are the resources that you have available to solve the problem? I.e., is it going to result in you having to buy a gymnasium for your house in order to solve the problem the way you want to? If that's so, then you have some economic considerations in whether you want to do that change or not. The fourth step is so problem identification is fairly easy sometimes. Sometimes that comes in your doctor's office, which I think is the least beneficial way for that to happen, because that's going to cost you some dollars that maybe you don't need to spend if we can do it in areas like we are now. Others, your own awareness is preferable. This kind of little test kind of thing, sometimes you'll find those kinds of things in Reader's Digest or Parents Magazines or Ladies Home Journals. You can get it from your spouse. Frequently you get it from your mother. Family, friends, boss. The boss can say, hey, you better stop being late to work or you're going to lose your job. The other thing that's interesting that I'd like to bring up is to become aware of your own negative self-thoughts or self-negative thoughts, because they probably produce more stress than your external environment may produce for you. Commitment. Commitment to change is a very difficult thing, and most people, when they begin to look at changing a lifestyle, i.e. stop smoking, I don't know, there are not very many smokers up here that I've seen. Maybe that's because I choose not to see them, but to stop smoking is a tremendous change. And most smokers that you talk to about stopping smoking say, I can't possibly do that. Totally overwhelmed by that. And so that kind of a person, if they're identifying that as a problem and they want to change, need to spend time building up commitment to that change, or they're not going to even attempt to do it. There are other things. Building commitment by writing a contract. The contract is simply something that I'm going to investigate and evaluate my exercise. program. And it's nice to do that all for yourself. It's sometimes very helpful to involve another person. And I will talk to my wife about that. And I usually put a time frame into a contract. Sometimes I'm likely to say, well, I can do that in 2 days. And if I do that, if I say that to myself, I think it's probably more realistic in my contract, knowing myself, to put down 6 days. Because I will tend to put that off a little bit. And making it so that I would go and use my wife as a sounding board also is more likely to make me do it, because then if I don't do it, she's going to say, gee, weren't you going to talk to me about evaluating your exercise program? What'd you find out? So that helps me a little bit and builds a little bit more commitment on my part to do it. And I need all the help sometimes that I can get, so I'm willing to use all the help I can get. So a contract to evaluate whether you're going to do anything about it, and enlisting the supporting person. The other thing I look at anytime I'm going to do change is, what am I going to get out of it? And I want, what I want out of any kind of change for myself is, I want a feeling state that I'm going to recognize, and that's part of how I'm going to measure whether I'm getting what I want. Is, if I got that feeling state that I want, then I'm going to it's going to be more likely that I'm going to do this, and I'm going to know when I've done it. The next step is further evaluation. Now, further evaluation, if you don't have the commitment, you'll never get through the further evaluation. Because there are several things involved in evaluating this. Like, you get yourself some 3x5 cards, and you keep them in your pocket, or if you don't wear pockets, you get yourself one of those little spiral notebooks, and you run a piece of yarn through the top, and you tie it on your belt or your buttonhole or something with a pen tied onto it, and you keep a record. Like, I clench my teeth, and I'd like to stop that. My dentist tells me that it's not a very good, healthy habit for my teeth. And so I'd like to stop that. So I would like to monitor how often during the day I clench my teeth. And so I get my little 3x5 card, and I've always usually got a pen in my pocket. And every time I find my teeth are clenched, I will write down what time it is, what's happening at the time. Are there certain persons around? Or are certain things going on? In other words, what precipitates my clenching my teeth? I'm going to need to know that. You know? And so I want to know the time of day and who's around or what's going on. And I'm going to keep a log of that. And it's kind of hectic to do that every day. So I might make my contract that I'm going to do that 3 times during the week for all day long. And at the end of the week, then I'll have that measurement. And I want to know, what are the barriers to my changing? And I have lots of barriers to my changing. One is, I say, man, this is really childish to keep these records. I'm old enough to do this without keeping these dumb records. So I keep my card in my pocket, and I conveniently forget to keep my record that day. Or, this is all silly, stupid, you know. Or, this is a pain in the neck. I just hate this record keeping. I don't like it. I'm too busy to do this. Too busy to have this kind of a program and devote this amount of time to it. I'm sure you can become aware of some of the barriers to your own change. As a cigarette smoker, I said, this is bigger than I am, and I can't possibly do this. I will become an unbearable person if I stop smoking. I will chew everybody out, I will be most unpleasant, and all my friends will leave me. Those are some of the things that I'm aware of that I dealt with years ago when I thought about stopping smoking. And then the last thing is to learn some methods to achieve your change.
Like smoking, you'd want to learn some non-smoking methods. Weight control, you're going to want to look at methods of weight control, methods of eating. You're going to want to know a little bit more about nutrition. So this is the time you begin to gain those skills that you're going to need for what you're going to do. If exercise is a problem, then you need to learn something about exercise so that you don't go out and embark on a program that's going to make you sicker rather than healthier. If you have back trouble, for instance, which is a very, very common place we hold our tension, you're going to want to learn some exercises to strengthen your back without hurting your back. So that's the place that you begin to learn this. And I'd like to come back and use what time we have left then after we go through those last two steps to talk about some of the methods of stress reduction, because that's really the nitty-gritty of it all.
John?
Yeah.
You said very briefly at the first one, identify the problem, you said something about your own self-evaluation or your own feeling of self-worth may be causing you more problems. Can you expand on that for just a minute?
Sure. Most of that deals with negative self, negative statements that I make to myself of, gee, that was a stupid thing to say. And if I find that kind of a recurring theme in my life, then I may want to try and do something differently. One of my favorites is I talk too much. And I think that may be true of the more education, the more the mouth is open. And it may be in direct correlation to how much time I had to keep my mouth shut while I was reading a book. I don't know. I have a lot of things that go on about control. Gee, you certainly didn't maintain very good control there. Or, gee, you certainly weren't very understanding of that person's place. Or I may say to myself, I didn't allow that person to state their case. I stated my case and told them what they ought to feel, or so what they ought to do, rather than let them find that for themselves. Those are all things that I say to myself. They're critical. They're sometimes very harsh. I can be just awful to myself. I'm more awful to myself sometimes than I am to other people.
It seems like a lot of the discussion is surrounding the symptoms of stress and dealing with the symptoms rather than the cause. And I'd like a little more discussion about why are people stressful? Our family, society, like dealing with smoking, trying to stop my smoking has to be in the context of why am I tense that I need to smoke, or why do I eat, or why do I eat?
Yeah.
It's not just a, well, let's have a program to stop smoking, it's let's get at why are we tense, why are we uptight, and how can we deal with that?
That's what we're doing here with the further evaluation, is you're finding out more about the specific symptom that you're unhappy with.
Yeah, I'm saying I'd like to talk about what some of those are.
What in our society are the major causes of people being uptight? I think from my impression of what I've heard is that the U.S. has particular problems with being uptight for the citizens of this country in our fast-paced society.
Okay, that would be a neat thing for another forum, like in the evening. I'd like not to deal with that in my dealings today. I'd like to kind of stay with some of the information about what to do when you want to change, which is basically what I wanted to deal with. This evaluation of an individual problem has a lot of different reasons for why I do what I do, and each person is going to be unique in exactly what it is why they do what they do. What I want to do is provide a tool then to change that. And at one of the evening forums would be an interesting thing to discuss why we have a problem with that in our country. Where are we? The change, you you use your methods of change after you've evaluated things to make one small achievable change. And you do that for maybe 2 weeks, that you use your methods, you're making your change, and after a couple of weeks, then you set up another contract and you monitor that for, you know, a week or so to find out whether you've done what you wanted to do. And it can be that short a time frame, too. Again, contracts at almost each one of these levels. This level, as you get to the end of this level, moving into the change, you need a contract, or you can use a contract. Remonitoring, you can set up a contract. And maintenance, you can set up a contract. Maintenance is difficult, but it takes a lot less energy than does the initial change. The initial change requires quite a bit of energy. Awareness, continuing to do it, being gentle with yourself when you find, whoops, I didn't do it that time. And saying, okay, that part of the awareness of your change, crime change, a long-established habit pattern. With time, and the more time that goes by, the more maintenance of your new habit becomes automatic, and you don't need to think about it anymore. Well, I'd like to go back now and talk about some of the ways of stress reduction. I'm curious if there are any people in the group who use any kind of meditation or yoga already. Does anybody do that? One, two. How many people use prayer? And try and set aside a little daily time for that. So I think all of those are about the same in achieving one thing, and that is muscle relaxation within your body. And that's the first step in achieving some change in stress behavior or stress levels. And there are a number of different ways to do it. Yoga does it. Prayer does it. Meditation does it. And a lot of people are going into what they call autogenics, which is a self-hypnosis type of thing. And somehow all of these methods kind of dovetail together and overlap each other so that it's very difficult to separate out a given method and tell you one method without you having the feeling that somehow you're being self-hypnotized or hypnotized by someone else or thought of a progressive relaxation technique of so-and-so or a muscle relaxation technique of someone else. Sometimes as we live our lives and we live them with the same muscular tension all the time, it's hard for us to know that we're tense. And in that sense, I would say that if you are using a prayer situation and you're not paying attention to muscles, you may have muscular tension being maintained that you don't know about. And in that sense, sometimes a muscle relaxation exercise that's designed to relax muscles may allow your prayer to occur with more flow, with more meaning to you, so that beginning to look at a muscle relaxation drill is one of the ways of doing it. I can tell you two different ways of doing muscle relaxation drill, and both of them have some merit. One is you can do it sitting. You can just put your feet flat on the ground and your hands comfortably on the end of the chair. You get into a very comfortable position, not leaning back and not leaning forward. One where you can allow yourself just to be. You can do it with your eyes open or closed. And you start at your feet, and you let your feet just become heavier and heavier and heavier. And you allow that to go up to your ankles,
slowly, heavy. You go up into the calves, and they're becoming very, very heavy, and very loose. Loose and heavy. And your knees becoming heavier and looser. I'm going to stop there because I can go on and it'll take another half an hour to get everything done, but by that time, some of you will fall asleep, and that's okay. Some of you will maintain an alertness, but by the time that drill is all done, it will be like you're a mind, and you can direct yourself to a part of your body and feel what's going on there, but if you don't voluntarily direct yourself, your body will be just there. You'll not be aware of it. And it will be loose. And when something is tense, you'll become aware of that part of your body. And then you go back and allow it to become very, very loose and very, very heavy. That's very close to autogenics or self-hypnosis. And people can teach you how to do that yourself. You can actually, if you have a little tape cassette, you can run that little tape yourself using positive statements all the way through. And you just work your way up to your thighs, to your hips. You can go then to your hands and up your arms. Then you go from your buttocks and your pelvis, your abdomen, on up. Another way is to focus on breathing. This is more tense towards the yoga type of relaxation, where you focus on your breathing. You allow your breathing to settle into your center, which is usually, for most people, somewhere between your pelvis and your chest cavity. And you become aware of your breathing. And as you breathe in through all the way from your fingertips on up into your center. You do the same with your legs. And as you breathe out so that the air comes out your fingertips, out your feet into the ground. And as you're doing that, you're letting your muscles go loose with each exhalation. You can do that very slowly. If you do that slowly, you won't have any problems in terms of blowing off all the carbon dioxide in your body, which then will make you dizzy. But you do that very slowly. You can do it sitting or you can do it lying down. I find lying down myself that I go to sleep faster that way. And so I tend to do it sitting when I do it. So if we get the muscles all relaxed, there is one thing that may continue, and that is that you may continue to have a lot of mental activity going on. And that mental activity, that loose muscles, very relaxed. But letting the mental activity goes on is a nice time for problem solving, praying. A lot of things can go on then that are very neat kind of things for you. To get to total relaxation, and that's relaxation of your mind as well as your body, is another thing. And the mind relaxation is another kind of a drill or exercise. And you do your muscle relaxation and now you're relaxed. Your muscles, and now you find things coming into your mind, and there are several different ways of handling that. You can, each time another thought comes in, you can out loud, you can say no, and another thought comes in, and you say no, out loud. As you find that you've slowed things down and there are less thoughts coming in, you can switch to an internal no. You can move then into imagining a pleasant scene, Holden Lake with the sun, not the clouds and the rain. Whatever's a nice, comfortable scene with some blues in it. Blue, psychologically, is a very relaxing color. And it's one that a lot of people who use color imagery use in terms of getting to relaxation without having to talk about relaxation to people. And after you find that the thoughts have stopped intruding on your nice scene, then move to a gray, to a black background in your imaging and allow blues to fade in and out of that. You can have blue clouds. Pay attention to the feeling that accompanies the blue on the gray or the black. And then begin to focus on keeping that kind of feeling as that the blue is there. And with practice, you will be able to achieve both the muscle and the mind relaxation within 30 seconds to 3 minutes of starting the exercise if you've practiced. And the practice is something that might be for 10 to 15 minutes twice a day for 2 weeks. And at the end of that 2 weeks, if you've stayed with your schedule, you'll probably be able to within the 30 seconds to 3 minutes, get into fairly total mind and muscle relaxation. And just doing that exercise will modify how stressed you feel during the day.
I find that by tensing the muscles first, and then you can relax them much faster or easier.
Thank you for bringing that up. I had been thinking of that when I was talking about two ways initially, and I forgot about it as I got involved. And that's a very, very nice way to do it too, and that is to just take your hand and your arm and tighten it up, all the muscles, just as tight as you can, and let it relax halfway. And then let that go halfway. And then let that go halfway is one method of doing it. Can you let it go all at once?
Yeah, I had a doctor teach me that. My kids were very tense.
Right.
And I used to go to him for a half hour session. And that he had me first tighten up my feet and my ankles. And I found that helped.
He's ahead of his time. many doctors won't spend that kind of time. Yes.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead of you, but I'm thinking of other ways to quiet one's mind. Even talking more.
What ways have you found?
Instead of saying no and stopping what's coming, it's like looking at it as a motion picture and just watching it go by. You can have a mind's eye and see
right.
It that way. Or I was also thinking of a kind of life a monk may have where you have a rosary where you repeat. Petitions
okay.
Or whatever.
Very good.
And I think that's a similar
process. People who do yoga, who use a mantra with their yoga, mm-hmm. are repeating something over and over and over, and that's another way of clearing one's mind. Thank you for bringing that up.
What kind of things do you repeat over and over? There are obviously...
Pick your own word. Love?
Mm-hmm.
God? What?
There's an excellent book in the library that I started to read last spring that I found very helpful. It's called The Other Side of Silence, and it's by Morton Kelsey. I don't know whether you're familiar with that, but it deals heavily on what we're talking about, and I have found it extremely helpful.
Good. Thank you. So you're finding that there are some resources, other people who are beginning to do this. Somebody is already doing it, maybe a neat helper for you. The other thing is that since there's so many roads to the same place, that it may be something that you can have a little flexibility with in finding something that's uniquely yours. Your own word.
We've talked about this relaxation that you can take maybe 15 minutes with. I wouldn't spend more than 20 minutes at a time with this, and I would not do it more than 4 times a day. I think if you try and do that often to start out with, that you may defeat yourself because you won't find enough time, or you'll take too much time, and then you say it isn't worth it because it takes so much time. The other thing is instant relaxation. And there are some techniques for instant relaxation, and you can use these. These are things that you might use several times during the day, in between stressing events. You can take your phone on your desk, and you can put a big R and paste it over that little center portion on your phone, or put a little red R on your telephone if it doesn't have the middle part of the dial. Relax. every time you look at that, you do your instant relaxation drill. And that just takes a few minutes. What that is you either sit or you stand, and you just take in a real deep breath, and you count to five, and as you let the breath out, you let all your muscles go loose. Just loose. And you do that two or three times. If you have the time, you image your own special, pleasant, calm scene, and you do that several times during the day. Again, you can set up a contract. I'm going to do that 5 to 10 times per day. And you set up little cues, little reminders, since it's something new that you're likely to forget in the busy, as you get involved in the busyness and the escalation of your own day. And you set up little cues around familiar things to get you to do that. Yes?
You sort of touched on this earlier, but I'm reminded of the story that someone told about the man who wanted to change his living habits, and he was going to be a runner, and he was going to run every day if it killed him. And lost the whole thing.
Yeah. I think when we bring our stressors with us into our stress reduction program, that it's doomed to failure. And that's back at problem identification and problem evaluation stages.
The Schramms have a term called freedom steps when they talk about lifestyle changes. And that could be used also for relaxation changes, too.
There are two other things that I want to talk about, and the one is fairly short, so I'll talk about it first, and then I'll talk about the behavior rehearsal. It's another tool for change. The first one is the self-reward concept. And a lot of people that I've talked to about change find self-rewards very childish. And that's the reason they don't use them. And actually what that is a big sabotage for the whole system. And you just kind of have to take it on the psychologist's testing and psychologist's research that people who use self-reward in their change process change fairly rapidly, successfully, and with a good deal of good grace and good humor. Self-reward may be something like, I may have a contract that I'm going to do the instant relaxation drill 5 to 10 times per day for the next week. When I've met my goal for the day, then I will allow myself 45 minutes at night of reading a novel that I like rather than trying to read professional stuff, which for me is kind of a treat. Make it something that's a treat for you, that you really enjoy. Or I may say, if I've done that 5 to 10 times, I'll ask Jan to give me a back rub when I'm playing home at night. And that, you know, that's a neat thing for me. If I don't do it, I have to be willing to forsake the reward. And when I do it, I have to be willing to assure myself the reward. That means that I have to negotiate with Jan as a helper to help me make that contract. You see, and if she's not willing to do that, then I'm going to have to find a different reward. Or a different helper, right? We went through that rocky road already. Okay. All right, now behavior reversal is another thing, and that is that it's a very interesting thing that you practice. You know what the stressor is. For instance, I can think of a stressor being a patient who comes into my office and says something like, you're not one of those doctors who uses medicine during labor, are you? Usually about that time go, after being accused of that for long enough, that has become a stress event for me. So I can begin to know that I can expect that kind of a question to come, and I can use behavior reversal drill to help me deal with that in a non-stress situation or more effectively so that I don't feel the amount of stress that I do when it happens. And I wrote down a nice way to guess. What I need to do then is I need to get my pencil and paper out again, and I need to look at when I become aware of the stress-producing event, what kinds of things, specific in the way of thoughts and actions, do I do now, and what might I do that's different? And write those down. And the next thing is, in preparing for that stress production, what can I do differently that's going to help me prepare to meet that in a different way? What thoughts and actions specifically will I do? And then handling the stress period itself, what thoughts and actions specifically am I going to do? And following through after the stressful period, what can I do? Thoughts and actions. And a lot of that involves self-reward at that point. Well, I didn't do everything, but I got 50% of what I said I was going to do done. And that's enough that I really feel good about that. And if you don't pat yourself on the back for 20%, what happens is you never get to 30. If you criticize yourself for doing 20% of what you said you were going to do, you never make it to 30, unless there's a lot of reward in there. Now, and that's the same thing. The reward for a child in being able to walk is that he can go where he wants to do and do a lot of the things that he wants to do. And if he gave up when he fell down the first, second, third, or 20th time, then that would, he'd never make it. And we're the same thing. If we give ourselves praise and credit for taking the first few steps, then we're likely to continue to take the steps. And if we don't give ourselves the praise and credit, then we're likely to stop trying to walk. And it's not quite the same simile, but it's enough similar that we can use that as a way of saying that small steps are the ones that we need to take, the achievable steps. If you set something up and you're saying in the back of your head, I don't know where I'll be able to do that, then you better revise your step. I'll stop now and I'll be around if people want to ask or ask questions.